A whole gang of media snoopers, including Jonathan Marks, scans from D.C. to daylight every Thursday here on Radio Netherlands. Their super-duper whopper-doppler-receiver gizmos pick out the essence of what's happening in the world of international broadcasting. Radio Netherlands, we have the technology.
Hello, this is Jonathan Marks for PCJ Online. Just about to push the button on another program from the media network Vintage Radio Archives.
Information control.
It's like nothing we've ever seen. Though.
It's really a miracle of evolution.
It is some kind of joke.
By Internet Real Audio G2, the Astra Digital Satellite System, and across the globe through AM, FM, and shortwave outlets. From Hilversum, this is Radio Netherlands. Media Network, the weekly survey of communications developments, produced and presented by Diana Jansen and Jonathan Marks.
Hello, glad you could join us for quite a varied show this week, with plenty of tuning tips from the Pacific, a look at the link between number stations on shortwave and internet security, and our gadget guru Bob Tomolsky is standing by to answer your questions.
But we start with broadcasting news, and unless you've been hibernating for the last few days, you'll probably have seen the dramatic pictures of the Moscow radio and television tower burning like a candle in the wind. At least four people are now known to have died as a result of the fire in the Ostankino Tower in Moscow, the city's main broadcasting and communications tower that was once the symbol of Soviet power. At 540 metres, it's the second tallest structure in the world, twice the height of the Eiffel Tower in Paris.
Not long after the blaze broke out, all but one of Moscow's 12 TV stations were off the air, and the flames also wiped out many radio transmissions. The fire initially knocked out the broadcasts of only six stations, such as NTV, TV6 and STS8, but shortly afterwards other channels were affected. Paging services went off the air, and apparently some of Russia's most important intelligence-gathering devices.
Vasily Strelnikov is an old friend of this program. He used to work for Radio Moscow World Service in the days of the USSR. He's now a VJ and voiceover artist for the satellite music television network MTV Russia. He followed the fire from the start, and so last night, Wednesday, we reached him in Moscow to hear his account of what happened.
Well, at first, and I was there at about 4 o'clock local time, it was just little puffs of smoke coming out from the various rings located at the very top of the tower, and it didn't really look very scary, very dangerous or anything. You know, you get the impression, well, maybe there's a minor fire up there, a short circuit, and it will be taken care of within the next couple of minutes. Having seen that, I wasn't very worried. I just thought, well, you know, they'll take care of it. It was just about 2 hours later when the televisions went blank, including my own television, and also the on-the-air cable television that I subscribe to coming out of the tower. Only when that went blank did I feel that there was a problem in the air. Some of my friends that actually do get to see the tower from their windows started telling me, calling me and saying, this is crazy, the whole thing is on fire, the whole thing is in smoke. So I thought, you know, what the heck, it's a lovely Sunday afternoon and I'll drive down to take a look at it. And what I saw was really scary. It was eerie because the thing was definitely engulfed in smoke. You could see fire coming out of the various sections. It was just a very eerie sight indeed.
Were you able to get close, though, because there was talk that the structure was in danger of collapsing?
Yes, I did get very close to it. In fact, I was standing right beneath it with my little camcorder there, capturing a bit of history and being just a nuisance, I guess, to the security people around. But at that time, there was no talk of the possibility of the thing actually crashing down. Only later, towards the evening at around 9 or 10 local time, did the threat actually start looming. And the radio news stations actually started reporting and asking for all people listening in right now in the vicinity of the tower to move away. And that's also the moment when I saw the police trying to move the crowds back as far as possible to around 500, 700 meters away from the tower.
Right, well, it's a few days after the incident now. I mean, the fire's obviously been put out on Monday. But what's happened now as far as radio and television is concerned? I mean, are things getting back to normal or what?
Well, here's the latest. What we're hearing from the State Committee on Construction, which is a very interesting name, or put it mildly, The emergency minister also, Sergei Shoigu, they're all saying that basically the thing is not going to crash down, even though there has been some damage to the cables that hold the tower upright inside the cable. Even though there's been some damage to that, the tower, they promise us that the tower is not going to fall. Number two, in terms of broadcasting, the screens are pretty much blank as we speak right now, but the latest reports say that Wednesday evening, the moment we're talking, RTR, which is Russian television and radio, the government channel, should be back on the air. What they're doing is basically they're setting up a makeshift transmitter, running some feeder line to it along the side of the tower at a level of 147 meters, and that should be back on the air. As for the rest of the stations, we are promised something should happen by the end of the week. Within the next few weeks, some form of broadcasting should be back. Of course, out of the 38 radio stations that broadcast out of the tower, none of them are back on the air, including Mayak and Radio Russia.
On the other hand, the television screens have gone blank. The FM, you say, has had problems, but is AM radio still working?
The AM is pretty much alive because most of the AM broadcasts originate from other sites within the city or around the city, so the AM broadcasts haven't really been affected that much. Mostly it's the radio stations that use the old UKV FM, the old Russian FM standard. Those are the stations that have been affected.
Do you think this has given a big boost to radio listening?
Well, in a way, yes. I mean, this is the folks here are so used to coming back from work in the evenings, you know, kicking back and watching a silly Brazilian soap opera or maybe even the newscast, which is just as silly. They're so used to it, and now the screens are blank, and most of the people are either taking strolls out on the streets. Thank God some people started reading, you know, and some people actually started listening to the radio. But then again, it's just interesting to see how long this will last.
Talking there to Vasily Strelnikov.
Radio and television feeds to transmitter sites outside the area, including shortwave broadcasts from foreign broadcasters, were not affected. Although the tower is said to be stable enough to be restored, the cost of restoring it may be more than the Russian government can afford. Estimates range from $500 to $1,000 million.
Big bucks. Now to your letters.
For decades, a brilliant inventor named Marconi toiled endlessly to make his dream of radio a reality. And here we are, blowing it all to hell. Call and talk. Media Network's answer line is open for your input on our output 24 hours a day. Just dial your international access code, then 3135-6724-222. You can also send us a fax to 3135-6724-252. Join the interactive revolution.
Richard Gladstone writes to us from Hitchin in Hertfordshire in the UK. He's working for a bank, and from what he writes, obviously has an important role to play in setting up e-commerce for his employer. He says he's been a lifelong shortwave listener and still marvels at the fact that between the broadcast bands, you'll still come across so-called number stations shouting out codes to agents in the field.
Her job. That particular number station is believed to be operated by British intelligence from a site in Cyprus. It's called the Lincolnshire Poacher after the little piece of music which precedes each string of numbers. Richard points out that those who study these stations believe the coding system is a so-called one-time pad. So if you're not the intended recipient, you're not going to be able to crack the code without very powerful computers and a lot of time. On the other hand, NASA recently admitted that hackers broke into their systems a few years ago during a space shuttle mission. And hardly a month goes by without some security problem being posted on the Microsoft website, requiring you to download a patch to protect your computer.
More and more radio-related websites are now offering goods for sale, particularly software and electronic components. The profit margin on computers and many electrical goods has dropped so low that many of the retailers are disappearing. Perhaps the biggest case in the Netherlands was a few years back when Tandy Radio Shack almost completely withdrew from the European market, arguing that keeping shops full of electronic components just isn't viable when the average consumer doesn't want to repair anything anymore. But if many radio purchases move to the web, just how safe is your money?
Well, we've been talking to Kees-Jan Kamer, a Dutchman who used to work for Philips New Media Center in Palo Alto in California. He still has his home base in Silicon Valley, but now he's chairman of a company called Pijnenberg Securelink. We shared Richard's observations with him that old-fashioned spine number stations on shortwaves seem to be secure, whereas the internet and security at the moment are not compatible.
Right now, it's not really something that goes together. But it has to be. Every year, some 30% more people are using the internet. There's a tremendous growth. Electronic commerce is increasing by about 90% per year. The number of broadband subscribers to the internet for streaming video applications is growing by some 120% per year. Pay-per-view, you know, all the e-commerce aspects, they absolutely demand that the internet will be safe. Right now, that is only partly the case. We see all these horror stories of the Lovebug virus and hackers stealing hundreds of thousands of credit card numbers from servers. Well, as long as people see those kind of messages in the newspaper, see it on television, they don't trust the internet. Now, there's an interesting statistic. Even in the United States, where people are sort of used to using their credit cards over the phone and sometimes also over the internet, still some 92% of people don't trust their internet enough to trust their credit card number to it. And even those who do use their credit card online, some 60% of people still feel uneasy about it. Right now, it's you leave your data behind and you don't really know what's happening with it.
So what about those one-time pad systems supposedly used by the spy number stations on shortwave? The systems seem to operate with two keys, one public and one that's very private.
Well, the way encryption works, you have a sender and a receiver. The sender has raw data and a key, which is a digital key. It's bits, and some sort of calculation and cipherment is carried out, which results in the ciphertext. The ciphertext cannot be read unless you have the corresponding key at the receiver side to unlock the message and you have your information back. There are two kinds of systems. There are symmetric keys and asymmetric keys. Symmetric keys means that on both sides you use the same key. Asymmetric, well, you'd use different keys. And the interesting thing of the asymmetric system, and it's called public key encryption, is that one of the keys is public. It's your, you have a public key, which everybody can look up. It's like in a telephone book. And with that key, people can read the messages that you have encrypted with your private key. Your private key is private, and it needs to remain private. So it's all about the management of keys and the generation of keys. You do that in a secure way, and in our case, we do that within a piece of silicon, a chip. And so your keys remain safe within that chip. And the chip does the encryption. And all the data that goes out of the chip is encrypted. And nobody can have access to it unless they have the matching key. So a hardware device like a chip is a very safe way to provide internet security. Now, the length of the keys is increasing because longer keys are more difficult to break. Right now, keys of length around 50 bits, for instance, are relatively easy to break those codes. 250-bit length keys are already much more difficult to break. In the case of our chip, we can handle keys up to 4,096 bits, which takes right now, with the fastest computers, millions of years to crack. So that's pretty safe, but then you need the fast hardware because otherwise these calculations, these encryptions, take too much time. You don't want to wait for it. So you need fast hardware to do it for you. And so in the end, security is a feature of a network. It's always there. It's always on. And you can always trust it. That's the way we are moving. That's not the way it is now, but that's the way we're moving.
But on what sort of time scale for the consumer? I mean, you talk about electronic banking, people worried about doing that. You also live in California, where they tend to be, well, 2 years ahead of the East Coast and maybe 4 years ahead of what's happening in Europe. How do you see the e-commerce and electronic banking then changing?
Let me start with where it is being used right now. So all the banks, all the traffic between banks and within banks, so the inter- and intra-bank traffic, is all done in an encrypted way. And they all use the longest possible keys, practically possible. But also your ATM machine that you use every day is protected in this same way. So all your data that you transmit are secured in this fashion. What we now want to do is to bring that security to your PC or to your DSL modem or cable modem or even to your cell phone, because those devices will be able to help you do some purchases over the net. And some are even talking about you use it to pay for your parking fee or whatever. You type in a code. But in all those cases, you trust certain financially related data or otherwise data that you want to protect to that medium, and also that needs to be protected.
So 2-3 years down the road, then I want to buy something. I need I might have a WAP-enabled phone or the G3 type phones. Will I actually have a physical chip then, or will it actually be built inside the phone? The fact that I've called a certain number means to say it knows exactly who I am.
Yeah, there will be different type of solutions. It's either a built-in chip, or it's a combination, some sort of combination of hardware and software. It has to be inexpensive. They can't cost hundreds of dollars. They have to be, a dollar or something. But also your smart card, which is relatively popular in Europe, is less popular in the US. Maybe that will change. But it's better to see if we can have secure methods in case of regular credit cards, if we can make that safe, people can trust it. But yes, in a couple of years from now, the attention is very much aimed towards providing that security, because otherwise certain businesses will not develop.
That was Kees Jan Koopman of Bannerberg Securalink. And if you're interested in more information about the spy number stations, check the publication section of the Media Network website. There are a number of people who do track those stations quite passionately.
Call and talk any time of the day or night and leave your comments and questions for Media Network. Dial your international access code and then 3135672422. When you call us, the world is listening.
Brian Clark in Auckland, New Zealand is our next guest. And we're going to start with a short follow-up on the Falkland Islands. 2 weeks ago, Andy Sennett mentioned that a tornado aircraft had clipped the medium-wave mast of the Falkland Islands broadcasting service in Stanley.
He also remarked that finding the special programmes for the Falklands is rather difficult in the vast schedules of BBC World Service. Brian.
Yes, I managed to track it down, Jonathan. It's on Tuesdays and Fridays at 21:30 UTC. It's a 15-minute broadcast. And one frequency is used, 11680 kilohertz. So that's the BBC calling the Falklands program Tuesdays and Fridays, 21:30, 11680 kilohertz. And I can hear it here in New Zealand, so I would guess it should be audible quite widely.
Right, from the Americas to Asia, and you've got an update on a serious trouble spot.
Well, this next one concerns East Timor, which we have covered before. And I've mentioned the FM radio station in Dili, the capital of East Timor, Radio Falantil. Now, they're now to carry special broadcasts from the Voice of America. And according to a VOA report earlier this month, they'll be airing 2 hours every morning in special English and Portuguese and 15 minutes of Indonesian in the evenings. And these broadcasts will be delivered into East Timor by satellite. Now, Radio New Zealand International continues to beam special programs to the New Zealand peacekeeping forces in East Timor. Currently, the frequency is 11720 kilohertz. That's between 1000 and 1305 UTC. But from the 4th of September, the special transmission changes to 17690 kilohertz from 1105 to 1305 UTC.
Tom Sundstrom passed on a message from Joe Farenholz, who lives in southwest Ohio in the USA, who in turn spotted an item in a local newspaper in Cincinnati in Ohio. It says that there are still plans to turn the former shortwave transmitter site of the VOA into a Cold War museum. That transmitter site, originally in private hands, was first used by VOA in 1944 and shut down in 1994. Plans for the sprawling site next to Interstate 75 north of Cincinnati also call for playing fields, like for baseball or soccer, to be laid out in concentric rings to symbolize radio waves and possibly partial restoration of the facilities.
I've actually been there. I'm very curious to see what it'll turn out to look like. Next to that Bethany site is a rather remarkable tower belonging to Cincinnati radio station WLW, which originally set up shop on that site in the 1930s, broadcasting on 700 kilohertz exactly, with 500 kilowatts of power in those days, 10 times the usual maximum in the US, although that's certainly not unusual for Europe, Africa and the Middle East. A couple of items now from Brian to round off, and let's go now to Central America.
Yes, Radio for Peace International in Costa Rica have made a frequency change, Jonathan. They were using 25910 kilohertz in the 11-meter band, but they've moved down now to 21815 kilohertz. This is upper sideband mode, a 2-kilowatt transmitter. The official schedule is 1200 through to 0600 UTC. Now, here in the South Pacific, we can hear the station throughout our local daytime, as early as 1900 UTC, right through to sign-off time, which is normally around about 0430 UTC. So that's Radio for Peace International, Costa Rica, 21815 kilohertz.
Amazing stuff. Thank you, Brian, for joining us.
Peter Hemsby writes to us from Doncaster in the UK. He's a fan of Bob Tomalski, aren't we all? And he has been following his so far accurate predictions about digital recordings, both audio and video.
Time to talk to our gadget guru again. Onkyo is a name that some people may know from the hi-fi world. Bob, perhaps you can explain why they're in the news as far as you're concerned.
Well, they had a press briefing recently in which they talked about a new hi-fi system. In fact, they're bringing out a complete new brand, and that brand is going to be called Integra. And the first three products include an amplifier, a preamp, and a DVD audio player. The whole shooting match will cost £10,000. But the really interesting thing is that the DVD player will have a digital video output, and that will be one of the first on the market to have such a connector. Now, the ramifications for this means that you could feasibly take an output and record it onto a digital recorder and thereby make perfect clones of DVD movies. But I put this point to Onkyo, and they surprised me by saying, indeed, that was one of the purposes for this connector. They could foresee a future where consumers would be allowed to make digital video recordings from movies directly to digital recorders such as DVHS.
But wait a minute, we've seen examples recently where Hollywood's gone after people putting up copies of movies on websites to the tune of $10 million. Do you think Hollywood even knows about this?
Not at the moment, but I think they soon will when they hear this program. It was utterly bizarre that you have a hardware manufacturer, if you like, going against the spirit of the agreement with DVD as far as copying is concerned. I put it to Onkyo that surely the main purpose for a digital video output on a player is to work in conjunction with future digital TVs and plasma screens to see, you know, better quality. And the marketing people, who frankly didn't understand the issues concerning copying, they said to me, oh yes, of course, you can use those outputs for that function as well. So I think really when it comes to the crunch, this is a case of a company who shot themselves in the foot at a press launch because they don't understand all the issues to do with digital link interconnections.
Mind you, the DVD player sounds very expensive, not something that's going to sort of swamp the market.
Indeed, that's the case. It's not only a DVD player, but it will play the new DVD audio discs. And it also has progressive scan output, which when used with certain projectors will give absolutely no line structure on the screen. So it's a very high-end product.
Well, what is happening as far as this recording business is concerned, especially DVD recording? I say that we've had several letters from people saying, you know, where's my DVD recordable?
Well, I've got some hot information on that, particularly regarding Philips. As you may know from the past, there are going to be three different incompatible DVD recording standards, and one of them is going to come from Philips. And Philips' unique selling point is that recordings made on their DVD recorder will be backwardsly compatible and play on any DVD machine. Well, the very latest is that there's going to be a delay. They had originally planned to launch DVD recordable, or what they call Plus RW, by Christmas of this year, worldwide. Now they say that there has been a delay due to the chipset that controls the recorder. They've got a problem that some of the chips in the chipset don't talk to each other correctly. So this means a delay. They say that they're going to show some product just before Christmas and ready for the CES, the Consumer Electronics Show, in the United States, which comes up in January of next year. They say that they will actually launch product on the market, what they call a soft launch, by the spring and summer of year 2001. But the big launch will be for the IFA show, the big electronic show in Berlin, in the autumn of next year. So those people hoping to have been able to buy a DVD recorder, certainly in Europe or in PAL areas, are going to be disappointed because it's not happening.
Now, Bob, you said Philips was only one of the systems. They have competition from two others. Who are they?
Well, the three different systems are DVD RAM, which is being introduced by a lot of Japanese companies and has been accepted by the DVD Forum as being, if you like, a multimedia product that will be used on home DVD recorders and also PCs. Then there's another proposal from Pioneer, which is already on sale in Japan, called DVD-RW, which comes from Pioneer, and other companies are getting interested in it. And this is designed purely for use in home domestic products, not for use with PCs. And then, of course, there's this new Philips standard, DVD-RW, which is supported by Philips and Sony's computer division, and also five other manufacturers for use on computers and also home machines. But the only manufacturer that has said that they will bring out a home machine apart from Philips is Thomson. So it's being pretty well seen as being a European-originated product. In Japan, both Matsushita, better known as Panasonic, and Pioneer have DVD recorders on sale using, of course, the NTSC system, compatible with NTSC TVs. And within the last week, Panasonic have launched that machine in the United States in a soft launch, meaning they've launched the machine, but they haven't had a big publicity razzmatazz about it. And so far, of course, these machines are catching on with people who are, you know, well-heeled. In other words, have got lots of money to spend. Because if you look in terms of cost, these machines sell for around about $1,500.
So a format war seems inevitable. Thanks, Bob.
More from both of us in September on the 7th. In the meantime, both of us wish you
a pleasant weekend.
I've been doing some listening between 3 and 30 megawatts. Some people get static. Some people get far-off countries. I just get a headache.
Serving the universe from Flevo, Radio Netherlands, with relays in Russia, Bonaire, and Madagascar. Any questions?
And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website, where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network programme. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.